Hello and welcome to Speaking with Carl Thornton Jr., your loyal host, your loyal producer, helping us to bring the program in with our theme song, No One Else, by Gregory Stafford. And we are getting ready to take another look into the future as we further explore the whole idea of artificial intelligence being connected with souls. So we've read some definitions, which is my preference, of souls. I like reading definitions, so that way we can all get on the same page. But that said, let me ask you this. How do you prefer to define souls? Are there some dictionary definitions, whether in secular dictionaries or Bible dictionaries? Maybe just your own common way of thinking of the word souls. Any of those ways that really, really just seem to grab you and say, well, you know, this is the way I prefer to think of souls. Well, feel free to be keeping that in mind as we have this discussion. We definitely want to, though, make sure that we're about the business of trying to stick as close to fact and reality as possible. And so that way we can have a more honest discussion about what we're discussing. I like for the discussion to be as honest as possible. And it is impossible to have honest discussions when information that is not true is introduced into the discussion. Or maybe not only introduced, but maybe for some people, 60%, 80% of the conversation. All right. We're taking a look at what BBC is sharing with us about the souls of AI, artificial intelligence. Humanoids with artificial intelligence, and eventually, some are saying souls, or at least suggesting, proposing souls. So one of the things that we mentioned last is that Thelma Lobel, who's author of Sensation, The New Science of Physical Intelligence, has said that our thoughts, our behaviors, our decisions, and our emotions are all influenced by our physical sensations. Now, please note, the contention is not that our physical sensations are controlled. That's not what she said. But our decisions and our emotions are influenced by our physical sensations, by the things we touch, by the texture of the things we touch, by the temperature of the things we touch, by the colors and the smells that we observe. All these, without our awareness, influence our behaviors, our thoughts, our emotions. And they're saying that there's a lot of research to back that up. And here's one example. In 2008, researchers at Yale University set out to see whether or not experiencing the physical sensation of warmth promoted interpersonal relationships. So study participants were greeted in an elevator by a research assistant who was holding a cup of coffee. In order to write down the participants' names, the assistant asked them to hold her coffee, which, as you probably guessed, was the point of the experiment. Half of the participants were handed a hot cup. Half were handed a cold cup. Each was then taken to the experiment room where they were asked to rate the personality of a target. As they hypothesized, wrote the researchers, people who had briefly held the hot coffee cup perceived the target person as being significantly warmer than did those who briefly held the cup of iced coffee. So what was their conclusion? Well, their conclusion was that experiences of physical temperature per se affect a person's impressions of and pro-social behavior toward other people without the other people even being aware of those kinds of influences. So what do you think, ladies and gentlemen? Should we try to make it a habit of carrying around a cup of hot coffee or a thermos of hot tea with us all year round? so we can positively influence people's opinions of us? I'm saying that facetiously. I'm really not trying to be sarcastic about it. I'm only being facetious, just making a joke there. But here's the point. What you think and what you physically feel and what you emotionally experience are all related. What we think, physically feel, emotionally experience are all related. And they're saying it's impossible to draw hard boundaries between them. Now, what are your thoughts about that? Think about this for a minute now. What you think, what you feel physically, what you experience emotionally. Can you think about experiences that you've had that may involve either or a combination of these and determine whether or not you can easily draw hard boundaries between them? And you can say, well, from an emotional standpoint, this is what I was experiencing. Physically, this felt cold, or physically, this felt rough. The material was very rough. What I think, now my guess is probably the greatest difficulty would be in drawing hard boundaries between what we think and what we feel until we get to the point where we really understand how to identify emotional feelings. And then we can probably do a better job of determining, well, I was feeling angry, as opposed to I was thinking, what in the world is that person thinking about when he cut in front of me like that? But they say that when it comes to what we think, physically feel, and emotionally experience, it's impossible, they say, to draw hard boundaries between them. You decide. Some researchers, in the meantime, are building on the work of embodied cognition, and they're applying it to the evolution of religion in humans. And although many sociologists have long focused on the emergence of religion as a purely mental phenomenon, new research is shining light on the important role that the human body is playing in shaping religiousness. Now, look at that again. Some sociologists have been proclaiming that religion is really all about the mind. It is a purely mental phenomenon. No aspect of our being is involved in religion but our minds, they're saying. But now some people are saying, no, hold on. It's not just the mind that's involved in our religious experience. Our minds are involved, but so are our bodies. And I would think that, number one, if our brains can illustrate, demonstrate through the hookups that they use to let us know, to literally see when the parts of the brain, regions of the brain, are being activated during religious experiences like meditation, prayer, etc. I would say that since the brain is physically part of the body, then yeah, I would agree with that, that there is an important role that the human body plays in shaping our religion. Some people talk about how they can literally feel a sense of heat, a sensation of heat during prayer, whether someone's praying for them, or they're praying for themselves, you name it. So I think the body is involved in that. The human body playing in shaping religiousness. Let me tell you, I was watching a program, I guess roughly a year ago, that had to do with the state that the world would be in if and when hubots, or humanoids, again, whatever phrase you term you prefer to use, when they are really, really prevalent on the earth. And they were demonstrating how the time may come when hubots, humanoids, artificial intelligence with the ability to reason, think for themselves, experience desires, etc. They were demonstrating that the hubots were becoming more and more like humans. And interestingly enough, during one scene, they showed a Hubot in a church. And the Hubot was sitting there in the church, just observing. It was not doing a church service. And so, as it turns out, he had walked into a church that was basically empty. But he was sitting there, and I think he was looking at the cross or an illustration of the Lord Jesus. And he had a very, very serious look on his face. And it was either while he was still in the church or soon after he left the church, he was talking with another Hubot. And he expressed concerns about the possibility of ever going to hell. Hubot praying at church and eventually asked another Hubot, a fellow Hubot, if it was real that at some point even Hubots could end up in hell. Interesting. Well, embodied cognition shapes the different dimensions of religious experience, including the way people represent the divine and other spiritual beings, moral intuitions, and feelings of belonging within religious groups. And this according to a team of researchers from Arizona State University. Think about actions that you might perform in religious settings, such as kneeling, lying prostrate, bowing your head, raising your hands, holding your neighbor's hands during prayer, for example, or lighting a candle, sharing a meal. These gestures mediate, actualize, and shape religious ideas. Or think about ethics, which have traditionally been communicated by religious traditions in terms of the body, for example. This is their contention. But here's the point they make. An eye for an eye. Or Jesus' teaching on turning the other cheek. These are teachings about ethics. Well, what do you think about that? Now, some people who are pushing the whole notion of souls being united within humanoids are using evolution as a jumping off point. And they talk about how, from their perspective, our emergence as human beings is one that has been hard won and slow moving, and say that it's taken us billions of years to reach this point. As a matter of fact, Carl Sagan has pointed out that the nitrogen in our DNA, the calcium in our teeth, the iron in our blood, the carbon in our apple pies were made in the interiors of collapsing stars, he claims. Well, human souling, some claim, emerges out of this organic cosmic evolutionary history. Well, Clayton says that that's not something that he buys into. Those who hope that future AI have souls are presupposing too simple a view of biological evolution. To deal with the soul question in artificial intelligence, he says we've got to get nerdy about what biological evolution actually is. An important school in evolutionary theory is called biosemiotics. Biosemiotics argues that the first self-reproducing cell already has intentions and interests. It therefore anticipates more complex organisms like ourselves. But we have no reason to think that's true for human-made robots. Yet they have intentions and interests from the very beginning, and that they anticipate more complex organisms like themselves. In other words, a different evolutionary process would mean that the analogy between human and artificial souling, artificial intelligence souling, would fail, which would severely undercut any argument for robots that have souls. Whereas human second-order desire is rooted in our unique flesh-and-blood way of being, it's tough to truly imagine truly desirous artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence that has real desires. Someone asked Siri, the artificial intelligence that speaks to us through Apple. Ask Siri this question. Siri, what do you desire? I'm sorry, Brendan. I'm afraid I don't have an answer to that. And of course, she doesn't have an answer to that because she doesn't need one. That's why Brown says it's cheating to talk about souling artificial intelligence. From his point of view, artificial intelligence would be asking the kinds of questions that philosophers ask. And he wouldn't consider them fundamentally important questions because they're so abstract. In contrast, humans with soul do have a certain biological and social value to it. Now, because it's designed for efficiency, artificial intelligence is notoriously bad with figurative language and abstract language. Developers who know that such language is a crucial aspect of human communication are working to remedy that. If, however, at some point they succeed in moving AI beyond literal language, it will be for the benefit of our species, not for the benefit of their species. Think about some of the most urgent questions that humans face. Again, identity and purpose. Who am I? And why am I here? Of course, some of the folks who are really pushing for the singularity, who really want the day when artificial intelligence will be greater, smarter than, stronger than humans, would say that the question is not who am I, but what am I? And this is the question that they want humans to begin to ask. They want humans to stop asking who am I, and instead to ask what am I? So that they can, I think that the goal would be to get us to see ourselves more and more like things, more and more like humanoids, hubots, artificial intelligence. Be a lot easier to dehumanize ourselves and others. So one person says that when she asks herself what she's doing here, she immediately launches into thoughts about her husband, her family, community, her relationship with the environment, and her beliefs about God. The same questions don't seem to cause Siri any existential trouble. So for example, you ask Siri, "Siri, what's your purpose?" Siri's response, "I'm here to help. Just ask, what can I say? And I'll show you what I can do." AI is created to perform functions. Siri is an intelligent personal assistant. Even if AI one day achieves a certain level of abstract thought, its instinctive sense of purpose will be programmed into it. Even artificial intelligence designed to think abstractly will be designed to think abstractly. In contrast, as Clayton points out, no one built teleology into biochemistry. Talking about souls and artificial intelligence, this is Art Farmer performing Soul Sides.